exit, I ran into two of our brothers doing donkey work for Do Trang while standing lookout. One made gestures indicating that they had something to report. Sighing, I strolled over. "What's the story, River?" The men called him Riverwalker. I did not know him by any other name.
"We got shadow traps that's been sprung. We got ourselves some new pets."
"Oh, no. Darn." I shook my head.
"That's not good?"
"Not good. Run, report it to Goblin. I'll stick with Ran till you get back. Don't dawdle. I'm late for work." Not true, but Taglians have little sense of urgency, and the concept of punctuality is alien to most. Shadows in the shadow traps, not a good eventuation, for sure. Near as we could determine, Soulcatcher had no more than 24 manageable shadows left under control. As many more had gone feral in the remote south and were developing reputations as Rakshasas, which were demons or devils, but not quite like those my northern forebrethren knew. Northern demons seemed to be solitary beings of considerable power. Rakshasas are communal and pretty weak individually. But deadly. Very deadly. In ancient myth, of course, they are much more powerful. They swat each other over the head with mountaintops, grow 2 heads for everyone chopped off by a hero, and collect the beautiful wives of kings who are really gods incarnate, but do not remember that fact. Things must have been much more exciting in olden times, even if they did not make a lot of sense from day to day. Catcher would keep a close eye on her shadows. They were her most valuable resource. Which meant that if they had been sent out to spy, she should know exactly where each was supposed to have gone. At least that is the way I would have done it if I were committing irreplaceable resources. I did that for every single man we committed to Willow Swan's capture. I knew how they were going to get to their places, and how they were going to get home, and everything they were supposed to do in between. And just like I figured Soulcatcher might, I would have gone looking for them personally if they had failed to return home. Goblin came hobbling into the early morning light, cursing all the way. He wore the all-covering brown wool of a Vayedine dervish. He hated the outfit, however necessary it was to disguise himself when he was outside. I did not blame him. The wool was hot. It was supposed to remind the holy men of the hell they were escaping by devoting themselves to chastity, asceticism, and good works.
"Where the hell is this shit?" he growled. "It's hot enough to boil eggs out here already."
"The boys say we've caught something in our shadow traps. I thought you might want to do something about that before Mama comes looking for her babies."
"Shit! More work."
"Old man, you just had something in your mouth I wouldn't even want in my hand."
"Vedna Priss, get the flock out of here before I give you a real language and lesson. And bring home something decent to eat when you come back. Like maybe a cow."
More than once, he and One Eye had conspired to kidnap one of the sacred cattle that wander the city. To date, their efforts have come to naught, because none of the men will go along. The majority have goony backgrounds. It took no time at all to learn that our shadow captives were not the only shadows that had run wild just before dawn. Rumor was rife. The stories of the murders the shadows committed banished news of the attack on the palace and the self-immolation of the Bodhi disciple. The killings were closer to home and closer in time. And they were grotesque. The corpse of a man whose life has been devoured by a shadow is a twisted husk of the creature that was. I insinuated myself into the crowd surrounding the doorway of a family where there had been multiple deaths. You can do that when you are little and limber and know how to use your elbows. I arrived just in time to watch them bring the bodies out. I was hoping they would be exposed to the public eye. Not that I wanted to see them myself. I saw plenty of those kinds of bodies during the Shadow Master Wars.
I just thought the people ought to see what Soulcatcher could do. She needed all the enemies she could get. The bodies were enshrouded already, but there was talk. I traveled on, learning that most of the dead had been people who lived on the streets. And there had been a lot of those, taken in no obvious pattern whatsoever. It looked like Soulcatcher had sent the shadows out just to demonstrate that she had the power and the will to kill. The deaths had evoked no great fear. People thought it was over. Most of them did not know any of the dead, so were not angry either. Curiosity and revulsion were the common emotions. I considered turning back to tell Goblin to fix the captured shadows so they would go out killing again tonight and every night thereafter, till Soulcatcher tracked them down. She would not look for trappers if she thought her pets had gone rogue, and the shadows would create a lot more enemies for her before their terror ended. At first it seemed the greys had faded from the streets. They were less in evidence than usual. But as I skirted Chor Bagan, it became evident why. They had the place under siege, apparently on the assumption that any Black Company survivors, having been branded bandits by the Protector, would hide themselves amongst Taglios's homegrown thieves and villains. Amusing. Sara and I insist that we have as little to do with the criminal element as possible, over One Eye's objections, and ignoring Bondo Trang's occasional lapses. That element included folk of dubious morals and discipline, who might serve us up for enough blood money to buy one more jar of illegal wine. I hoped they and the Greys had fun. I hoped somebody forgot the rules and their day turned bloody. That would make life easier for me and mine. Any trip across town exposes you to the cruel truth about Taglios. Beggary exists there like nowhere else in the world. Were someone to sweep the city clean and organize the beggars into regiments, they would number more than the biggest army the captain put together in the days of the Shadowmaster Wars. If you look the least bit foreign or prosperous, they come at you in waves. Every attempt is made to exploit your pity. Not far from Do Trang's warehouse, there is a boy with neither hands nor lower legs. Somehow, blocks of wood have been affixed in their place. He crawls around with a bowl in his mouth. Every cripple over the age of 15 claims to be a wounded hero of the wars. The children are the worst. Often they have been maimed deliberately, their limbs deformed evilly. They are sold to men, who then feel they own them because they feed them a handful of toasted grain every few days. A new mystery of the city is that men of that stripe seem to run the risk of cruel tortures and their own careers as deformed beggars, if they do not watch their backs very, very carefully. My route took me near one such. He had one arm he could use to drag himself around. The rest of his limbs were twisted ruins. His bones had been crushed to gravel, but he had been kept alive by a dedicated effort. His face and exposed skin were covered with burn scars. I paused to place one small copper in his bowl. He whimpered and tried to crawl away. He could still see out of one eye. Everywhere you looked, life proceeded in the unique Taglian fashion. Every vehicle in motion had people hanging off it, sponging a ride, unless it was the rickshaw of a rich man, perhaps a banker from Cowlery Street, who could afford outrunners armed with bamboo canes to keep people off. Shopkeepers often sat on top of their tiny counters because there was no other space. Workmen jogged hither and yon with back-breaking loads, violently cursing everyone in their way. The people argued, laughed, waved their arms wildly, simply stepped to the side of the street where no one was lying to defecate when the need came upon them. They bathed in the water in the gutters, indifferent to the fact that a neighbor was urinating in the same stream 15 feet away. Taglios is an all-out, relentless assault upon all the senses, but engages none so much as it does the sense of smell. I hate the rainy season, but without its protracted sluicings out,
Taglios would become untenable even for rats. Without the rains, the endemic cholera and smallpox would be far worse than they are. Though the rainy times bring outbreaks of malaria and yellow fever. Disease of every sort is common and accepted stoically. And then there are the lepers, whose plight gives new depth of meaning to horror and despair. Never do I find my faith in God so tested as when I consider the lepers. I am as terrified by them as anyone, but I do know enough about some individuals to realize that very few are being visited by a scourge they deserve. Unless the Guni are right, and they are paying for evils done in previous lives. Up above it all are the kites and crows, the buzzards and vultures. For the eaters of carrion, life is good, till the dead wagons come to collect the fallen. The people come from everywhere, from 500 miles, to find their fortunes, but fortune is an ugly two-faced goddess. When you have lived with her handiwork for half a generation, you hardly notice anymore. You forget that this is not the way life has to be. You cease to marvel at just how much evil man can conjure simply by existing. Chapter 12. The Library. Created by and bequeathed to the city by an earlier mercantile prince, who was much impressed by learning, strikes me as a symbol of knowledge, rearing up to shed its light into the surrounding darkness of ignorance. Some of the city's worst slums wash right up against the wall, enclosing its ground. The beggars are bad around its outer gates. Why is a puzzlement? I have never seen anyone toss them a coin. There is a gateman, but he is not a guard. He lacks even a bamboo cane. But a cane is unnecessary. The sanctity of the place of knowledge is observed by everyone. Everyone but me, you might say.
Good morning, Adu,
I said as the gateman swung the wrought iron open for me. Though I was a glorified sweeper and fetch-it man, I had status. I appeared to enjoy the favor of some of the Badrilok. Status and caste grew more important as Taglios became more crowded and resources grew less plentiful. Caste has become much more rigidly defined and observed in just the last 10 years. People are desperate to cling to the little that they have already. Likewise, the trade guilds have grown increasingly powerful. Several have raised small private armed forces that they use to make sure immigrants and other outsiders do not trample on their preserves, or that they sometimes hire out to temples or others in need of justice. Some of our brothers have done some work in that vein. It generates revenue and creates contacts and allows us glimpses inside otherwise closed societies. Outside, the library resembles the more ornate Guni temples. Its pillars and walls are covered with reliefs, recalling stories both mythical and historical. It is not a huge place, being just 30 yards on its long side and 60 feet the other way. Its main floor is elevated 10 feet above the surrounding gardens and monuments, which themselves cap a small knoll. The building proper is tall enough that inside there is a full-size hanging gallery all the way around at the level where a second floor should be. Then an attic of sorts above that, plus a well-drained basement below the main floor. I find that interior much too open for comfort. Unless I am way down low or way up high, everyone can watch what I am doing. The main floor is an expanse of marble, brought from somewhere far away. Upon it, in neat rows, stand the desks and tables where the scholars work, either studying or copying decaying manuscripts. The climate is not conducive to the longevity of books. There is a certain sadness to the library, a developing air of neglect. Scholars grow fewer each year. The protector does not care about the library because it cannot brag that it contains old books full of deadly spells. There is not one grimoire in the place. Though there is a lot of very interesting stuff, if she bothered to look. but that sort of curiosity is not part of her character. There are more glass windows in the library than anywhere else I have ever seen. The copyists need a lot of light. Most of them these days are old and their sight is failing. Master Santaraxita often goes on about the library having no future. No one wants to visit it anymore. He believes that has something to do with the hysterical fear of the past that began to build soon after the rise of the Shadow Masters, when he was still a young man. Back when fear of the Black Company gained circulation, before the company ever appeared. I stepped into the library and surveyed it. I loved the place. In another time, I would gladly have become one of Master Centaraxita's acolytes. If I could have survived the close scrutiny endured by would-be students. I was not Goonie. I was not high caste. The former I could fake well enough to get by. I had been surrounded by Goonie all my life. But I did not know caste from within. Only the priestly caste and some selected commercial caste folks were permitted to be literate. Though familiar with the Vulgate and the High Mode both, I could never pretend to have grown up in a priestly household fallen on hard times. I had not grown up in much of any kind of household. I had the place entirely to myself, and there was no obvious cleaning that needed doing right away. It ever amazed me that no one actually lived in the library, that it was more holy or more frightening than a temple. The Kangali, the parentless and homeless and fearless boys of the street who run in troops of 6 to 8, see temples as just another potential resource, but they would not trouble the library. To the unlettered, the knowledge contained in books was almost as terrible as the knowledge bound up in the flesh of a creature as wicked as Soulcatcher. I had one of the best jobs in Taglios. I was the main caretaker at the biggest depository and replicatory of books within the Taglian Empire. It had taken 3.5 years of scheming and several carefully targeted murders to put me into a position I enjoyed way too much. Always before me was the temptation to forget the company. The temptation might have gotten me, had I had the social qualifications to be anything but a janitor who sneaked peeks into books when nobody was looking. In quick order, I conjured the tools of my purported trade, then hurried to one of the more remote copying desks. It was out of the way, yet offered a good line of vision and good acoustics, so I would not be surprised doing something both forbidden and impossible. I had gotten caught twice already, lucky both times with tantric books illuminated with illustrations. They thought I was sneaking peeks at dirty pictures. Master Centaraxita himself suggested I go study temple walls if that sort of thing appealed to me. But I could not help feeling that he began to harbor a deep suspicion after the second incident. They never threatened me with dismissal or even punishment. But they made it clear I was out of line, that the gods punish those who exceed caste and station. They were, of course, unaware of my origins or associations, or of my disinclination to accept the Goonie religion with all its idolatry and tolerance for wickedness. I dug out the book that purported to be a history of Taglios's earliest days. I would not have been aware of it had I not noticed it being copied from a manuscript so old that much of it had appeared to be in a style of calligraphy resembling that of the old annals I was having so much trouble deciphering. Old Baladitya, the copyist, had had no difficulty rendering the text in modern Taglian. I have salvaged the moldy, crumbling original. I had it hidden. I had a notion that by comparing versions, I could get a handle on the dialect of those old annals. If not, Girish would be offered a chance to translate for the Black Company. An opportunity he ought to pounce on considering the alternative available at that point. I already knew that the books I wanted to translate were copies of even earlier versions, at least two of which had been transcribed originally in another language entirely. Presumably that spoken by our first brothers when they came down off the plain of Glittering Stone. I started at the beginning. It was an interesting story. Taglios began as a collection of mud huts beside the river. Some of the villagers fished and dodged crocodiles, while others raised a variety of crops. The city grew for no obvious reason, beyond its being the last viable landing before the river lost itself in the pestilential delta swamps, in those days not yet inhabited by the Nuangbo. Trade from upriver continued overland, to all the great kingdoms of the south. Not a one of those was mentioned by name. Taglios began as a tributary of Baladil-Tyla, a city great in oral histories and no longer in existence. It is sometimes associated with some really ancient ruins outside the village of Videha, which itself is associated with the intellectual achievements of a Curus empire, and is the center of ruins of another sort entirely. Baladil-Tyla was the birthplace of Radranak, the warrior king who nearly exterminated the deceivers in antiquity, and who harried the handful of survivors into burying their sacred texts, the books of the dead, in that same cavern where Murgan now lay entombed with all the old men and their cobwebs of ice. Not all this was information from the book I was reading. As I went, I made connections with things I had read or heard elsewhere. This was very exciting stuff for me. Here was an answer for Goblin. The princes of Taglios could not be kings because they honored as their sovereigns the kings of Nanda, who raised them up. Of course, Nanda was no more, and Goblin would want to know why. In that case, the Taglian princes could not just crown themselves. There were plenty of precedents. From the looks of the history of the centuries before the coming of the Black Company, that had been the favorite pastime of anybody who could get three or four men to follow him around. I overcame a powerful urge to rush ahead and look for the era when the free companies of Kadivar exploded upon the world. What had happened before that would help explain what had happened when they did. Chapter 13. A sudden startled thrill ran through me. I was not alone anymore. A long time had passed. The sun had swung several hours across the sky. The quality of the light within the library had changed. It had become a much paler version of its morning self. Presumably the clouds had passed away. I did not jump or, I hope, show any immediate outward reaction. But I did have to respond visibly to my awareness of the presence of whoever was standing behind me. Perhaps it was his breath that alerted me. The curry and garlic were strong. Certainly I never heard a sound. I brought my heartbeat under control, smoothed my features, turned. The master of the library, my boss, Surendranath Santaraksita, met my gaze.
"Durabi, I believe you are reading."
At the library, they know me as Durabi Day Banerjai, an honorable name. A man of that name died beside me in a skirmish near the Dhaka woods a long time ago. He did not need it anymore, and I would do it no harm. I did not speak. The truth would be hard to deny if the master had been there long. I was halfway through the book, which was of the bound sort and contained no illustrations whatsoever, not even one tantric passage.
"I have been watching you for some time, Durabi. Your interest and skill are both evident. It's clear that you read better than most of my copyists. Yet it's equally obvious that you aren't of the priestly caste."
My face was still as old cheese. I was wondering if I should kill him and how I could dispose of the corpse if I did. Perhaps the stranglers could be framed. No. Master Santaraksita was old, but still hale enough to throw me around if I tried to throttle him. Being small has definite disadvantages at times. He had 8 inches on me, but at the moment that seemed like several feet. And someone else was moving around at the other end of the library. I heard voices. I did not drop my eyes the way a menial should. Master Santaraksita already knew I was more than a curious sweeper, though a good one. I kept the place spotless, That was a company rule. Our public characters had to be morally straight and excellent workers, which did not make some of the men at all happy. I waited. Master Santaraxita would decide his own fate. He would decide the fate of the library that he loved.
So, our Dorabi is a man of more talents than we suspected. What else do you do that we don't know about Dorabi? Can you write as well?
I did not answer. Of course.
Where did you learn? It has long been the contention of many of the Badralok that those not of the priestly caste do not have the mental facility to learn the high mode.
Still I did not speak. Eventually he would commit to movement in some direction. I would respond accordingly. I hoped I could avoid destroying him and his brethren and stripping the library of whatever might be useful. That was the course one I wanted to follow years ago. Never mind being subtle. Never mind not alerting Soul Catcher to what was happening right under her nose.
You have nothing to say? No defense.
A pursuit of knowledge needs no defense. Sri Sondel Ghosh, the Janaka, declared that in the Garden of Wisdom there is no caste.
Albeit in an age when caste had much less meaning.
Sondel Ghosh spoke at the University of Vikramas, where all the students had to pass an exhaustive examination before they were allowed to enter the grounds.
Do you suppose many students of any caste were admitted who were unable to read the Panas and Pashids? Sondel Ghosh was not called the Janaka for nothing. Vikramas was the seat of Janae religious study.
A janitor who knows about a religion long dead. We are indeed entering the age of Kadi, where all is turned upon its head.
Kadi is the favorite Taglian name for Kina, in one of her less vicious aspects. The name Kina is seldom spoken, lest the Dark Mother hear and respond. Only the deceivers want her to come around.
Where did you acquire this skill? Who taught you?
A friend started me out a long time ago. After we buried him, I continued to teach myself.
My gaze never left his face. For a goofy old boffin whose stuffiness was grist for the mockery of the younger copyists, he seemed remarkably flexible mentally. But then, he might be brighter than he seemed. He might realize that he could buy himself a float down river to the swamps if the wrong words passed his lips. No. Master Surendranath Santaraksita did not yet live in a world where one who read and cherished sacred texts also cut throats and trafficked with sorcerers, the dead and rakshasas. Master Surendranath Santaraksita did not think of himself that way, but he was a sort of holy hermit, self-consecrated to preserve all that was good in knowledge and culture. This much I had discovered already through continuous observation. I had figured out also that we might not often agree on what was good.
You just wish to learn, then?
I lust after knowledge the way some men lust after pleasures of the flesh. I've always been that way. I can't help it. It's an obsession.
Santaraxita leaned a little closer, studying me with myopic eyes.
You are older than you seem.
I confessed.
People think I'm younger than I am because I'm small. Tell me about yourself, Dorabi De Banerjai. Who was your father? Of what family was your mother?
You will not have heard of them.
I considered refusing to elaborate. But Dorabi De Banerjai did have a story. I had been rehearsing it for 7 years. If I just stayed in character, it would all be true. Stay in character. Be Dorabi caught reading. Let Sleepy worry about what to do when it was time for Sleepy to come back on stage.
You denigrate yourself overmuch,
Santaraxita said at one point.
I may have known your father. If he was the same Dulal De Banerjai, who could not resist the Liberator's call for recruits when he raised the original legion that triumphed at Gorja Ford?
I had named dead Dorabee's father already. I could not take that back now. How could he know Dolal anyway? Banerjee was one of the oldest and most common of traditional Taglian surnames. Banerjees were mentioned in the text I had been reading till months ago.
That may have been him. I never knew him well. I do recall him boasting that he was one of the first to enroll. He marched off with the Liberator to defeat the Shadow Masters. He never came back from Gorja Ford.
I did not know much more about Dorabee's family, not even his mother's name. In all Taglios, how could it be possible I would encounter anyone who remembered the father? Fortune is indeed a goddess filled with caprice.
Did you know him well?
If that was so, the librarian might have to go. Just that would make my exposure inevitable.
No, not well. Not well at all.
Now Master Centaraxita seemed disinclined to say more. He seemed worrisomely thoughtful. After a moment, he told me,
"Come with me, Dorabee."
Sri?
You brought up the university at Vikramas. I have a list of the questions the gate guards put to those who wanted to enroll. Curiosity impels me to subject you to the same examination.
I know little about Jane, Master.
If the truth were told, I was a bit shaky on the tenets of my own religion, always having been afraid to examine it too closely. Other religions do not stand up to the rigorous application of reason. For all, we have things like Kina stalking the earth. And I really did not want to find myself stumbling over any boulders of absurdity protruding from the bedrock of my own faith.
The examination was not religious in nature, Dorabee. It tested the prospective student's morals, ethics, and ability to think. Janaka monks did not wish to educate potential leaders who would come to their calling with the stain of darkness upon their souls.
That being the case, I had to get into character very deeply indeed. Sleepy, the Vedna soldier girl from Jaikur, had stains on her soul blacker than a shadow of all night falling.
Chapter 14.
Then what did you do?
Tobo asked.
Around a mouthful of spicy Taglian-style rice, I told him, "Then I went out and made sure the library was clean."
And Surendranath Centaraxita remained where he was, stunned into immobility by the answers he had received from a lowly sweeper. I could have told him that anyone who paid attention to the storytellers in the street, the sermons of mendicant priests, and the readily available gratuitous advice of hermits and yogis could have satisfied most of the Vikrama's questions. Darn it! A Vedna woman from Jaikur could do it.
"We got to kill him,"
One Eye said.
"How do you want to do it?"
"That's always your solution these days, isn't it?" I asked.
"The more we get rid of now, the fewer there'll be around to aggravate me in my old age."
I could not tell if he was joking. "When you start getting old, we'll worry about it."
"Guy like that will be easy, little girl. He won't be looking for it. Bam! He's gone. And nobody'll care. Strangle his ass. Leave a rumble on him. Blame it on our old buddy Narayan. He's in town. We need to put all kinds of shit off on him."
"Language, old man." One Eye babbled on, putting a name to animal waste in 100 tongues. I turned my back.
"Sarah? You've been very quiet. I've been trying to digest what I picked up today. By the way, Jol Barundandi was distraught because you stayed home. Tried to take your kickback out of my wages. He finally found Min Subredil's limit. I threatened to scream. He would have called my bluff if his wife hadn't been around somewhere. Are you sure it's safe to let this librarian live? If it looked natural, No one would suspect. It may not be safe, but it could pay dividends. Master Centoraxita wants to make some kind of experiment out of me. To see if a low-caste dog really can be taught to roll over and play dead. What about Soulcatcher? What about the shadows? Did you learn anything? She loosed everything she had. Just an impulse. No master plan except to remind the city of her power. She expected the victims to be immigrants who live in the streets. No one much cares about them. Only a handful of shadows got back before dawn. Our captives won't be missed until tomorrow. We could go catch a few more.
Bats, Goblin said, inviting himself to take a seat.
One eye appeared to have dozed off. He still had hold of his cane, though.
Bats! There's bats out there tonight!
Sara offered a confirming nod. Goblin said,
Back before we marched against the Shadow Masters, we killed all the bats. Had bounties on them big enough for bat hunters to make a living. Because the Shadow Masters used them to spy.
I recalled a time when crows were murdered relentlessly because they might be acting as Soulcatcher's far-flying eyes. You're saying we should stay in tonight?
Mind like a stone axe, this old gal.
I asked Sara. What did Soulcatcher think about our attack? It didn't come up where I could hear. She pushed some sheets from the old annals across. The body suicide bothered her more. She's afraid it might start a trend. A trend? There could be more than one monk goofy enough to set himself on fire?
She thinks so?
Tobo asked.
Mom, are we going to call up Dad tonight?
I don't know right now, dear.
I want to talk to him some more.
You will. I'm sure he's interested in talking to you, too. She sounded like she was trying to convince herself. I asked Goblin, Would it be possible for you to keep that mist thing going all the time, so we could keep Mergen connected? At any time we wanted, we could just send him where we needed to know about something?
We're working on it.
He took off on a technical rant. I did not understand a word, but I let him roll. He deserved to feel good about something. One eye began to snore. The smart would stay out of reach of his cane anyway. I said, Tobo could keep notes all the time. I had had this sudden vision of the son of the analyst taking over for the father, the way it goes in Taglian guilds, where trades and tools pass down generation after generation.
In fact,
One Eye said, as though no time had passed since the last remark, and as though he had not been faking sleep a moment ago.
Right now's the time you could play you a really great big ol' hairy-assed, old-time company dirty trick, little girl. Send somebody down to the silk merchant's exchange. Have them get you some silk, different colors, big enough to make up copies of them scarves the stranglers use. Them rumals. Then we start picking off the guys we don't like anyway. Once in a while we leave one of them scarves behind. Like with that librarian.
I said, I like that. Except the part about Master Centoraxita. That's a closed subject, old man. One Eye cackled.
Man's got to stand by what he believes.
It would get a lot of fingers pointing,
Goblin said. One Eye cackled again.
It would point them in some other direction, too, little girl. And I'm thinking we don't want much more attention coming our way right now. I'm thinking maybe we're closer to figuring things out than any of us realizes.
Water sleeps. We have to be taken seriously.
That's what I'm saying. We use them scarves to take out informants and guys who know too much. Librarians, for instance.
Would I be correct in my suspicion that you've been thinking about this for a while? And by chance you just happen to have a little list all ready to go? Very likely any such list would include all the people responsible for his several failed attempts to establish himself in the Taglian black markets. He cackled. He took a swipe at Goblin with his cane.
And you said she's got a mind like a flint hatchet.
Bring me the list. I'll discuss it with Mergen next time I see him.
With a ghost? They got no sense of perspective, you know.
You mean maybe he's seen everything and knows what you're really up to? Sounds like a perspective to me. Makes me wonder how far the company might have gone if our forebrethren had had a ghost to keep an eye on you. One Eye grumbled something about how unfair and unreasonable the world was. He had been singing that song the whole time I had known him. He would keep it up after he became a ghost himself. I mused. You think we could get Mergen to winkle out the source of the stink that keeps coming from the back there? Where Do Trang hides his crocodile skins? I know it's not them. Croc hides have a flavor all their own. One Eye scowled. He was ready to change the subject now. The odor in question came from his beer and liquor manufacturing project, hidden in a cellar he and Do Trang thought nobody knew about. Bondo Trang, once our benefactor for Sara's sake, now was practically one of the gang because he had a powerful taste for One Eye's product, a huge hunger for illegal and shadowy income, and he liked having tough guys on the payroll who would work hard for very little money. He thought his vice was a secret he shared only with One Eye and Gota. The three of them got drunk together twice a week. Alcohol is a definite Nuang Bo weakness.
I'm sure it's not worth the trouble, little girl. It's probably dead rats. Bad rat problem in this town. Do Trang puts rat poison out all the time. By the pound. No need to waste Mergen's time chasing rodents. You've both got better things to do.
I would be talking over a lot of things with Mergen if I could deal with him directly. If we could catch and keep his attention. I would like to know firsthand everything that ordinarily came to me through other people. I imply no malice, particularly from Sara. But people do reshape information according to their own prejudices. Including even me, possibly. Though, until now, my objectivity has been peerless. All my predecessors, though, their reports must be read with a jaundiced eye. Of course, most of them made the same observation in regard to their own predecessors. So we are all in agreement. Everyone is a liar but us. Only Lady was unabashedly self-congratulating. She missed few opportunities to remind those who came later how brilliant and determined and successful she was, turning the tide of the Shadow Master Wars when she had nothing to begin building upon but herself. Mergen was, putting it charitably, less than sane much of the time. Because I lived through many of the times and events he recollected, I have to say he did pretty good. Most of what he recorded could be true. I cannot contradict him. But a lot he set down does seem fanciful. Fanciful? Last night I had a long chat with his ghost, or spirit, or Ka, whatever that was. If that was really Mergen, and not some trick played on us by Kina or Soulcatcher, we can never be 100% certain that anything is exactly what it appears to be. Kina is the mother of deceit, and Soulcatcher, to quote a man far wiser and more foul of mouth than I, is a mud-sucking lunatic. Chapter 15.
This is excellent, I enthused again as Sara summoned Mergen once more. She herself betrayed no enthusiasm for the task. Tobo's hovering did nothing to improve her temper. Before he does anything else, I want to have him check on Surendranath Centaraxita.
So you don't trust the librarian after all?
One Eye said. He chuckled.
I think he's all right, but why hand him a chance to break my heart if I can avoid it by keeping an eye on him?
How come it's got to be my eye?
There's not a sharper one available, is there? And you already turned down a chance to work on the annals. I've got to do some heavy studying in those tonight. I might be on the track of something. The little wizard grunted. I think I found something at the library today.
If Centaraxita doesn't trip me up, I may have an outside view of the first coming of the company by the end of the week. An independent historical source has been a goal almost as long as has been our desire for a look at uncontaminated editions of the earliest three volumes of the Annals. Sara had something else on her mind. Barundandi wants me to bring Sawa to work, Sleepy. No. Sawa is on hiatus. She's sick. She has cholera. If that's what it takes. I'm finally starting to make some real headway. I'm not going to let that slide now. He's also been asking about Shiki. Back when Tobo had accompanied his mother to the palace occasionally, she had called him Shikandini, which was a joke Jald Barundandi never got, because he was not the sort to pay attention to historical mythology. One of the kings of legendary Hastinapur had had a senior wife who seemed to be barren, a good goonie. He prayed and made sacrifice faithfully, and eventually one of the gods stepped down from heaven to tell him he could have what he wanted, which was a son. But he was going to get it the hard way, for the son would be born a daughter. And, as they say, it came to pass that the wife brought forth a daughter, whom the king then named Shikandin, a name that also existed in the female form, Shikandini. It is a long and not that interesting story, but the girl grew up to become a mighty warrior. The trouble started when it came time for the prince to take a bride. Many of our public characters have obscure allusions or jokes built into them. That helped make things more interesting for the brothers playing the roles. I asked, "Do we have any reason to snatch Barundandi, other than his general sliminess?" I thought he was most useful right where he was. Any replacement was sure to be as venal and unlikely to be as kind to me and Subradil. And could we even get him out where we could touch him? Nobody suggested a strategic reason for grabbing the man. Sara wanted to know, "Why do you ask?" "Because I do think we could lure him, if we dress Tobo up pretty, then refuse to cooperate unless Barundandi meets him outside." Sara was not offended. The ruse is a legitimate weapon of war. She looked thoughtful. "Maybe Gokhale instead?" "Perhaps. Though he might want someone younger. We can ask Swan. I was thinking of catching Gokhale in the place where the deceivers killed that other one. The enemy's leading personalities seldom left the palace, which was why we had chosen to go get Willow Swan." Sara began to sing. Murgan was reluctant again tonight. I said, "Murgan should look at that joy house, too. He'd be the best way for us to check it out. Though, no doubt, we could find several brothers willing to risk themselves in an extended recon." Sara nodded, did not break the rhythm of her lullaby. "We might even..." "No. We could not just burn the place once Gokhale had been inside long enough to become seriously engaged. Nobody would understand why I wanted to waste a perfectly good whorehouse, though a few might find a deadly fire highly amusing. One eye looked like he was sleeping again, but was not. Without opening his eyes, he asked,
"You know where you're going, little girl? You got some kind of overall plan?"
"Yes." I was surprised to find that I really believed that. Intuitively, somewhere inside, though I had not known it consciously, I had engineered a master plan for the liberation of the captured and the resurrection of the company. And it was starting to come together, after all these years. Murgan showed up, muttering about a white crow. He was distracted. I asked the wizards, "You figure out how to anchor him here yet?"
"Always some damn thing," One Eye grumbled. "Whatever you do, it's never enough."
"It can't be done," Goblin admitted. "But I still don't see why we would want to."
"He hasn't been very cooperative. He doesn't want to be here. He's losing his connection to the real world. He'd rather sleep and wander those caverns." I took a stab in the dark. "And put on his white wings, be Kadi's messenger."
"White wings?"
They did not read the annals.
The albino crow that turns up sometimes. Sometimes Murgan is inside it, because Kina puts him there, or used to put him there. And now he keeps stumbling back in, the way he kept stumbling around in time once Soulcatcher got him started.
How do you know that?
I read sometimes. And once in a while I even read the annals and try to figure out what Murgan didn't tell us. What he might not actually have known himself. Right now he may be enamored of being the White Crow, because that way he gets into actual flesh that ranges outside the caverns. Or he may just be falling under the influence of Kina as she wakes up again. But none of that ought to matter much right now. Right now we have a bunch of spying we need him to do. I want to be able to twist his arm if I have to. The mission comes first. Murgan himself taught me that. Sara said, "Sleep is right. Anchor him. Then I'll grab him by the nose and kick his behind until I've got his undivided attention." She seemed suddenly optimistic, as though taking a direct approach with her husband was some totally new concept fraught with unexpected hope. She went straight to outright confrontation, drawing Tobo in to support her. Maybe she could rebuild Murgan's ties with the outside world. I turned to the others. I found another Kina myth this morning. In this one, her father didn't trick her into going to sleep. She died. Then her husband got so upset that...
"Husband!"
Goblin squeaked.
"What husband?"
"I don't know, Goblin. The book didn't name names. It was written for people who grew up in the Goonie religion. It assumes you know who they're talking about. When Kina died, her husband was so grief-stricken, he grabbed up her corpse and started doing that stomping dance Murgan talks about her doing in his visions. He got so violent that the other gods were afraid he would destroy the world. So her father threw an enchanted knife that cut her up into about 50 pieces, and every place one of the chunks fell became a holy place for Kina's worshippers. Just reading between the lines and guessing, I'd say Katavar is where her head hit the ground.
I got a notion One Eye was on the right track, back when he was going to desert and retire.
One Eye gawked. Goblin saying something positive about anything he ever did?
The hell I was. I just had an attack of juvenile angst. I got over it and got responsible again.
There's a new concept, I observed. One Eye responsible.
For catastrophes and afflictions, maybe, Goblin said.
One Eye said,
I don't get the Kina story. If she died back at the beginning of the world, how could she be giving us trouble for the last 20 or 30 years?
It's religion, dimwit, Goblin barked. It don't got to make sense.
Kina is a goddess, I said. I guess gods can't ever be completely dead. I don't know, One Eye. I didn't make it up. I just reported it. Look, the Goonie don't believe anybody dies, really. Their soul goes on.
Goblin chuckled. If these Goonie got it right, you're in deep shit, Rump Boy. You gotta keep going round on the wheel of life till you get it right. You got a lot of karma to work off.
Stop now, I snapped. We're supposed to be working. Work. Not the favorite swear word of either man. I told them, you get Murgan nailed down, or chained down, whatever it takes to keep him under control. Then you help Sara try to get through to him. I have a suspicion things are going to get exciting before long, and we'll need him wide awake and cooperative. One Eye grumbled.
Sounds to me like you don't plan to be here looking over our shoulders.
I was up already. Clever man. I have some reading and some translating to do. You can manage without me, if you concentrate. One Eye told Goblin,
we got to get that little bit into the sack with some guy'll pork our brains out.
His cure for all ills, even at his age. I paused to say, when he's given everything else the once-over, have him search for Narian and the Daughter of Night. I did not need to explain how badly we needed to keep those two from achieving their ends. Chapter 16.
I've got it!
I shouted, running back to the corner where Mergen's friends and family were trying to torment him into taking a broader interest in the world of the living.
I found it! I've got it!
I hope you ain't gonna give it to me,
One Eye grumbled. My excitement was so loud and intense, even Mergen, who was caught in the mist and being a real pain about his situation, paused to study me.
I had a feeling, an intuition the other day, that the answer was in the annals, in Mergen's annals, and I'd just overlooked it. Maybe because it had been so long since I read them, and I wouldn't have thought to look for it back then.
And behold, One Eye sneered. There it is, in ink of gold on Mayrek's tinted paper with little scarlet arrows saying, Here it is, little girl, the secret of the...
Stuff it, dustbag! Goblin snapped. I want to hear what Sleepy found.
Though it would have been him doing the sarcasm if One Eye had not beat him to it.
It's the whole thing with the Nuang Bo. Well, maybe not all of it, I said, as Sara scowled at me. But the part with Uncle Doge and Mother Goda, and why they came out of the swamp when they didn't have a debt of honor like your brother, Sara?
Sara's brother, Tai Day, was under the glittering plane with Mergen, serving as his bodyguard because of what Mergen and the company had done to help the Nuang Bo during the siege of Jaekoor.
Sara, you must know some of this.
That may be true, Sleepy. But you'll have to tell us what you're talking about first.
I'm talking about whatever it was that the Thousand Voices stole from the Temple of Gangisha sometime between the end of the siege and when Uncle Doge and your mother invited themselves to come stay with you here in Taglios. Mergen touches on it over and over, lightly. But I don't think he ever really caught on completely. Whatever it was that the Thousand Voices stole, Uncle Doge called it the key. From other internal evidence, I think it had to be another key to the Shadow Gate. Like the Lance of Passion. The Thousand Voices was what the Nuang Bo called Soul Catcher. I think if we had that key, we could open the way for the captured. If I was guessing right here, I had created a whole new line of inquiry. Why the Nuang Bo? Sara began shaking her head slowly.
Am I wrong?
What is the key, then?
I'm not saying you're wrong, Sleepy. I'm saying I don't want you to be right. There are things I wouldn't want to be true.
What? Why?
Myths and legends, Sleepy. Ugly myths and legends. Some of them I'm not supposed to know. And I know I don't know them all. Probably none of the worst. Doge was their curator and keeper, as you are for the Black Company. But Doge never shared his secrets. Tobo, find your grandmother. Bring her here. Get Do Trang, too, if he's here.
Bewildered, the boy shuffled away. A spectral whisper came out of the device where Mergen waited.
Sleepy may be right. I recall suspecting something like that and wondering if I could find a good history of the Nuang Bo so I could figure it out. You'll need to question Willow Swan, too.
I said, I'll do that later, separately. Swan doesn't need to know what's happening. Are you paying attention now, Standard Bearer? Do you have any idea where we're at and what we're doing?
I do.
His tone was resigned, though. Like mine when I know I have to get up in the morning, want to or not.
Tell me about the Temple of Gangisha, then. Both of you. Why would this key have been kept there?
Sara did not want to talk about it. Her whole body said she was caught up in a ferocious internal struggle.
Why is this so hard? I asked.
There is old evil in my people's past. I'm only vaguely familiar with it. Doge knows the whole truth. The rest of us just understand that our ancestors were guilty of a great sin, and until we expiate it,
our whole race is condemned to live in bitter destitution in the swamp. The temple was a holy place long before some Nyingbo began to adopt Guni beliefs. It protected something, possibly the key you mentioned, the thing Uncle Doge has been looking for. Where did the Nyingbo come from, Sarah? That question had intrigued me since childhood. Each few years, hundreds of those strange people would pass through Jaekor on pilgrimage. They were quiet and orderly and stayed to themselves. And a year after they arrived from the north, they would pass through again, going back that way. Even at the height of the power of the Shadow Masters, that cycle had continued. Nobody knew where they went. Nobody ever cared. Out of the south somewhere, a long time ago. From beyond the Don de Presh? I could not imagine subjecting little children and old folks to the rigors of a journey of that magnitude. The pilgrimage had to be very important indeed. Yes. But there are no pilgrimages anymore. The one that had ended up with hundreds of Nyingbo dying in Jaekor was the last of which I was aware.
The Shadow Master and the Kialune Wars made the next few times impossible. There's supposed to be a pilgrimage every 4 years. Each Nyingbo de Duang has to make the pilgrimage at least once as an adult. For a while the lack was no problem. But now the Protector will not permit the people to meet their obligations.
Bondo Trang rasped from his wheelchair, having arrived in time to catch the drift of my interrogation.
There are things we do not discuss with those who aren't Nyingbo.
I got the feeling he was saying the same thing twice at one time. One way for my benefit and another for Sarah's. This could be ticklish. We dared not offend Bondo Trang, whose friendship we needed. If we lost him, we also risked losing Sarah, whose value to the company could not be calculated. Nothing is ever simple and straightforward. I told the old man the way I had it figured. Kai Goto waddled in just as I started, my eyes widened as One Eye gallantly offered her his seat. It is a world just chock full of wonders. The little wizard went and got another seat, which he set next to Goda's. The two of them sat there leaning on their canes like a couple of temple gargoyles. A ghost of ancient beauty peeked out of the wide, permanent scowl that Goda used for a face. I explained the situation. But here's the mystery. Where is the key today? Nobody volunteered that information. I'd think that if the Thousand Voices still had it, she'd be running down to Kialune every month to round up a new gaggle of killer shadows. If it could open the Shadow Gate safely. And if Uncle Doge had it, he wouldn't be roaming around looking for it. He'd be back in the swamp, blithely letting the rest of us go to Al-Shale in a handcart. Am I wrong, Mother Goda? You know the man. You must be able to offer something. Able, perhaps. Willing, of course not. The big thing that stands out to my ear about the company's sojourn in the south is the stubborn silence of so many people about everything. Like if we even discovered our own birthdays, that would be something we could use against them. The fact that the company now consists almost entirely of native soldiers has not helped at all. Our life does not attract the knowledgeable, educated portion of the population. If a priest offered to sign on, he would send him downriver, knowing for certain that he was a spy.
"You got the damned gimmick?"
One Eye asked.
"Who?" "You, little girl. The villainous you. I didn't forget that you are Soulcatcher's guest for a while. When she caught you on the road coming back from running that message for Mergen, I haven't forgotten that when our sweet old Uncle Doge rescued you, it was incidental. He was looking for his missing trinket, the key. Not so?"
"That's all true. But I didn't bring anything away from that, except a few new scars and the rags on my back."
"What we need to know
Then, is has Soulcatcher been looking for the key?
We don't know for sure. But she does fly down south occasionally, and patrols the old ground like she's looking for something. We knew that, courtesy of Morgan. Though till now, her behavior had made no sense.
So who else could have snatched this prize?
One-Eye did not press Goda for any information. The way to get around Goda was to ignore her. In time, she would insist that she be noticed. I remembered a pale, ragged little girl who, though just 4 years old, had seemed ageless, silent and patient, confidently unfrightened by her captivity. The daughter of night. She never spoke to me once. She acknowledged my existence only when she had to, because if she irritated me too much, I might take all of what little food Soulcatcher allowed us. I should have strangled her then, but at that time, I did not know who she was. At that time, I was having trouble remembering who I was. Soulcatcher had drugged me and gone down inside me and found half what made me me, then had tried being me in order to infiltrate the company. I still wonder how well she really knows me. Certainly I do not want her to find out that I survived the Kialune Wars. She might have the emotional weapons to crush me. Narion came to get the Daughter of Night, I mused aloud. But I caught only glimpses of him. An extremely skinny little man in a filthy loincloth who didn't look anything like the terrible monster he was supposed to be. It didn't occur to me it was him till I realized I wasn't going to be released, too. Since I couldn't see what they were doing, I don't know if they took anything with them. Morgan, you saw them then. I have it written down that you did. Did they take anything away that might have been this key?
I don't know. Believe it or not, you really do miss some things out here.
He seemed piqued. I realized I had not bothered to hear what he had to report. I asked. Not much useful, Sara told me, cutting Morgan off before he could retell everything from the beginning. Can you find them now? I foresaw trouble. There was an unwilling connection to Kina. If the Dark Goddess was stirring again, he would have to be careful not to attract divine attention. We have these priorities regarding the Daughter of Night. Kill her. Failing that, kill her sidekick. Failing that, make sure she can't copy the books of the dead, which I'm sure she'll start doing again as soon as she develops a reliable connection with Kina. Finally, recapture anything she and Sing might have carried off when Narion rescued her.